You came through for me, and I am going to come through for you. The 8-year assault on your Second Amendment freedoms has come to a crashing end. You have a true friend and champion in the White House.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 248. My name is Melvin, and I want to thank you so much for being here. So to lead off today's show today, I want to discuss, albeit briefly, because when it comes to this particular issue, I know how crazy I tend to go with this issue. I've done entire shows about this issue, and I'm not going to do that today, but I do want to bring to your attention an article by Michael Ian Black, an op-ed over at the New York Times, and it's headlined, "The Boys Are Not All Right." Quoting here, "I used to have this one-liner. If you want to emasculate a guy friend when you're at a restaurant, ask him everything that he's going to order. And then, when the waitress comes, order it for him." It's funny because it shouldn't be that easy to rob a man of his masculinity. But it is. See, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School now joins the ranks of Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech, Columbine, and too many other sites of American carnage. What do these shootings have in common? Guns, yes, but also boys. Girls aren't the ones pulling the triggers. It's boys. It's almost always boys. America's boys are broken, and it's killing us. The brokenness of the country's boys stands in contrast to its girls, who still face an abundance of obstacles, but go into the world increasingly well-equipped to take them on. The past 50 years have redefined what it means to be female in America. Girls today are told that they can do anything, be anyone. They've absorbed that message. They're outperforming boys in school at every level. But it isn't just about performance. To be a girl today is to be the beneficiary of decades of conversation about the complexities of womanhood in its many forms and expressions. Boys, though, have been left behind. No commensurate movement has emerged to help them navigate toward a full expression of their gender. It's no longer enough to be a man. We no longer even know what that means. Too many boys are trapped in the same suffocating, outdated model of masculinity where manhood is measured in strength, where there is no way to be vulnerable without feeling emasculated, where manliness is about having power over others. They're trapped, and they don't even have the language to talk about how they feel about being trapped, because the language that exists to discuss the full range of human emotion is still viewed as sensitive and feminine. Men feel isolated, confused, and conflicted about their natures. Many feel that the very qualities that used to define them, their strength, aggression, competitiveness, are no longer wanted or needed. Many others never felt strong or aggressive or competitive to begin with. We don't know how to be. And we're terrified. But to even admit our terror is to be reduced, because we don't have a model of masculinity that allows for fear or grief or tenderness or the day-to-day sadness that sometimes overtakes us all. Case in point, and this is the author talking. A few days ago, I posted a brief thread about these thoughts on Twitter, knowing I would receive hateful replies in response. I got dozens of messages impugning my manhood. The mildest of them called me a soy boy, which is a common insult among the alt-right that links soy intake to estrogen. And so the man who feels but wishes to preserve his fully masculine self has only two choices, withdraw or rage. We've seen what withdraw and rage have the potential to do. School shootings are only the most public of tragedies. Others, on a smaller scale, take place across the country daily. Another commonality among shooters is a history of abuse towards women. To be clear, most men will never turn violent. Most men will turn out fine. Most will learn to navigate the deep waters of their feelings without ever engaging in any form of destruction. Most will grow up to be kind, but many will not. We'll probably never understand why any one young man decides to end the lives of others, but we can at least see a pattern, and that pattern is glaringly obvious. It's boys. I believe in boys. It's the artist talking still. I believe in my son. Sometimes, though, I see him, 16 years old, swallowing his frustration, burying his worry, stomping up the stairs without telling us what's wrong, and I want to show him what it looks like to be vulnerable and open. But I can't, because I was once a boy, too. There has to be a way to expand what it means to be a man without losing our masculinity. I don't know how we open ourselves to the rich complexity of our manhood. I think we would benefit from the same conversations girls and women have been having for the past 50 years. I would like men to use feminism as an inspiration, in the same way feminists use the civil rights movement as theirs. I'm not advocating a quick fix. There isn't one. But we have to start the conversation. Boys are broken, and I want to help. Michael Ian Black, New York Times op-ed. I could have just given you a synopsis. Could have just given you a little bit of that. But I couldn't, because every single sentence was more important than the one that preceded it. And I'm going through a period in my life right now where I'm dealing with young women. They're not just little girls anymore. They're young women. They're adults. I recently went to a choir concert. I was watching my eldest daughter sing with all of her friends on stage, and it hit me. None of them look like kids. They all look like adults. They're going out into the world fairly quickly. Mine are too. And with that, I've begun talking with them more. We have the fun, dumb conversations, and we laugh as well. But I'm beginning to have more of the conversation with them about what they're going to do out in the world. How they're potentially going to deal with overly aggressive males. Men who think that locker talk is okay. That's just the way things are. It's always the way it's been. Guns are a sign of strength. Fighting is a sign of masculinity. And anybody that disagrees with the two previous statements, well, you guys are just pussies. And that's the other thing. Are we talking about, when we say that word, are we using that word in reference to cats or female genitalia? Me thinks it's the latter. And that toxic masculinity isn't doing anybody any favors. It's not doing anybody any good. And I've talked with my girls and I said, the people that you associate with, you can associate with really anybody. Be friends with anybody. But if you bring a man up in this house and I hear the word feminazi or bitch, trick, hoe, any of the words that we use that are designed only to oppress women, I'm going to put him out on his ass. And I'm not even going to think twice about it. I suppose, in terms of feminism, I've become militant. I think you have to be. The way he described growing up, watching his own son come of age right now, and the way he came of age. Yeah, it was in my house. Boys don't cry. That's what girls do. It's not acceptable. And I've got this, most of you have never met me, most of you never will, but I've got this wild personality where I wave my hands around a lot, use lots of funny voices, and sometimes my wrists go a little limp. And I like all that. I like the way that feels. I'm still interested in the ladies. I suppose it wouldn't matter if I wasn't. But I got to a point where I realized I can't shake this. This is who I am. This is what I look like. And this is how I'm going to act. Because I like being this way. And the people that I have around me now, to know me, to love me, for sure. And I'm the only one like me. And I think what we're dealing with the president and with the people that supported him. Not just the men, but also the women. This idea of toughness, this chest pounding. James Comey's book is coming out pretty quick here. He's doing a book tour. He's stopping in Portland. It sold out weeks ago. Even at $40 a ticket, it sold out weeks ago. And in the description of the book, parts of the book have already leaked. He described Trump as this. He said, the guy has zero emotion all the time, with one exception. And that is when he is being criticized. He's being criticized. He can't handle it. Sarah Huckabee Sanders gave on Friday, this past Friday, so this show will probably come out on Sunday or Monday, maybe even Tuesday. But the previous Friday, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, his press secretary, came out and when asked about James Comey, began, not literally, obviously, breathing fire into the microphone. One of the things James Comey said is this guy doesn't care about anybody but himself. He seems to have no emotion, and oh yeah, I've never, ever seen him laugh. And every time the president opens his mouth, it's this extremely toxic, tough talk. And he loves guns. Kill, kill, kill. We have a drug problem. Kill. You know, we got kids being killed in high school. Kill, kill, kill. And this is a boy problem. It's a male problem. It's not a problem I have, but it could very quickly become my problem. At my eldest daughter's school about a week ago, they had a lockdown. And they don't just have lockdowns if there's active shooters. They have lockdowns if there's police activity in the neighborhood as well. And my wife reached out to me and she says, hey, our eldest daughter said that her school's in lockdown. And then I'm not getting any more messages from her. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And these are texts that I'm getting from my wife. She can't make calls from school. There's no service out there. She lives in a rural area. And so I was already in my car and I began making a beeline for the school. But the minute I got those messages, already at that moment, I started thinking that I lost one of my own. I lost one of mine. It's my eldest. And I all at once, I started feeling the emotions that come with facing that kind of a tragedy. We're not hearing from her. School's in lockdown. And I've got tunnel vision. And I'm tearing through my neighborhood. Which is not wise. I could have very easily lost control of a car and ended up killing someone else's kid. But I had to get there. And I had to know right away. So even without knowing how she's doing, or even what's happening, I've already began bargaining with the idea that I might have just lost one of my children. I'm already going through the emotions. I arrive at the school, and I don't see any cop cars around. Heart rate starts returning to normal, but not completely normal. I ran up in the front office and threw the doors open. And there's two ladies sitting behind the counter, sort of one middle-aged and one younger. The younger one was clearly a student helper. And they said, hey, I introduced myself. And I said, what's going on here? They explained to me that there is some activity in the area, as to my daughter was. Told me that she's just fine. And I didn't know what to do. I'd already gone through all these terrified emotions. And I didn't know what to do. Everything's okay. There's no police activity. Nobody's hurt. There's no active shooter. Everything's fine. So I simply said, okay, ladies, thank you very much, as you were. And I turned around and walked out the door. But I almost ran down the hall and yanked my daughter out of the school. I get outside the school. I get a text message from my wife. I've heard from our daughter. Everything is fine. Yes, I know, because I stormed to the front office. So I know everything's fine. And they now know at the school that, you know, so-and-so's dad is an effing freak. And although it didn't turn out, my worst fears weren't confirmed. I began the process that people go through when that kind of thing happens. So here's hoping in my life and in your life, you're never touched by the tragedies that we have, where men who don't know how to deal with their own masculinity, don't know how to deal with their own emotions and feelings, don't know how to square with what it means to be a man. Let's hope that in your life and in my life, that never ever manifests into mass murder. If it does, my heart goes out to you. But I believe, and this isn't a political thing, this affects us all. Whether you're conservative, whether you're progressive, this affects us all. When these nutbags go into these schools and begin mowing people down, they're not asking, are you a conservative? Are you a progressive? Did you give money to the libertarian? They're not asking. And the bullets don't have names on them. They have destinations when they end up in people's heads and chests, backs and buttocks and all the other terrible stories I've heard. But they don't have names on them when they go into the school. They have a resting place that might send your kids to their resting place. We all need to get a handle on this. We all need to stop saying, be a man. And we need to start letting boys know that it's okay. And that kind of thing happens to us all. And it's okay to feel that way. And it doesn't make you weak. I believe that I'm incapable of crying. I can't do it. No matter what, because it was pounded into me as a kid. Boys don't cry. Pussies feel that way. So on and so forth. And it's damaged me. I'm in a better place now than I was then. But the damage is still there. You know, even all of the homophobic things that I learned as a kid, you know, boys don't kiss boys and girls don't kiss girls. My initial response to this day, when I see same-sex people kissing, back of my mind, it'll be a little voice that says, that ain't right. But then me, the more conscious me, will go, of course it's all right. They love each other. There's not a damn thing wrong with that. But the things I was taught still nag at me in the back of my head. On the way home from school that day, from my daughter's school, I drove by a house. And they got a big sign in front of their yard. And the sign says, our Second Amendment right is under attack. The battle lines have been drawn. And these are our choices. We can protect our children, or we can protect our murder weapons.
We have to harden our schools, not soften them up. A gun-free zone to a killer or somebody that wants to be a killer, that's like going in for the ice cream. That's like, here I am, take me. These people are cowards. They're not going to walk into a school if 20% of the teachers have guns. It may be 10%, it may be 40%. And what I'd recommend doing is the people that do carry, we give them a bonus. And I'm the biggest believer of the Second Amendment that there is, okay? I am the biggest. But I'll tell you what, I spoke with the NRA at the top people, and I spoke, and they gave me tremendous support. I spoke to them, and they're ready to do things. They want to do things. You know, they're good people. They're patriots. They love this country. But the NRA is ready to do things. And, you know, people like to blame them, and they do have power and all of that.
Stick around, ladies and gentlemen. We've got a heck of a show today. TPP, Paul Ryan, gaslighting, neo-Nazis, a God we trust, the erosion of the white vote, the year of the woman. Yo, let's go.
Yeah, and people who are incompetent, right? I mean, you were talking earlier about all these cabinet secretaries who could see their other folks getting in trouble for the same things they're doing, and they kept doing it. You know, you look at some of these people who wouldn't be able to get hired outside of a Trump administration, and they're having senior roles. I mean, Trump keeps putting these TV personalities he likes. He put his favorite financial TV personality as his economic advisor this week. Now there's rumors that he's going to put his favorite Fox guy as his VA secretary. I mean, who's next? Does Homer Simpson get a job by the time we're done here?
So the personnel problems at the White House continue. The chaos presidency that we were promised, it's as alive as it ever was. And now we've got a pretty clear picture of what the fall is supposed to look like for the midterms. So when I listen to conservative talk radio right now, and I still do that, I always hear like Limbaugh or Hannity, well, they're saying that it's going to be a bloodbath. They're saying that it's going to be a blue wave, and I disagree because the bang bang drive-by media run by the Negroes, blah, blah, blah. It's not going to... Okay, all right. So it looks pretty clear. The party in power generally loses seats. And they generally lose seats when those seats already have incumbents in them. And if there's no incumbent in those seats, then it's far more likely that someone else is gonna get that seat. So Paul Ryan decided this week, and there have been rumblings about it for some time, he decided that he's not going to run for the House of Representatives again. He hasn't done an in-person town hall with his constituents in almost 4 years. So we kind of saw this coming. Pretty clear a long time ago that he quit giving an S about his constituents and quit giving an S about his job. So in Paul Ryan's district, the seat, it looks like it's going to come down to two people. So the Democrat that's running for that seat, his name is Randy Bryce, the Iron Stash. Okay, that's what they call him because he's an iron worker and he's got this big bushy mustache. And I've heard plenty of interviews with Randy Bryce, and he sounds pretty brilliant. I think he's going to be great. But remember, he's running in an area, a district that kept voting for Paul Ryan. So Randy Bryce is far from an automatic thing. So who is in the lead for the Republican Party in the primary in Janesville, you know, or in Paul Ryan's district in Wisconsin? What does the Republican look? Is he a Paul Ryan Republican? Is he a numbers cruncher? Is he the big budget guy, big egghead with the numbers and all the? No, he's an anti-Semite neo-Nazi, and he's not being quiet about it. So it's Randy Bryce versus the neo-Nazi. Now, in any normal district, and by the way, if you've got Nazis in your district, you're not normal. In any normal district, I'd say if a Nazi is running against a steel worker, then the Nazi is going to lose. But despite the fact that Paul Ryan hasn't been serving his district for some time and they kept voting for him, it's hard to tell how this is going to turn out. Paul Ryan came to Washington, D.C. in his 20s, in his early 20s. And he was the numbers guy. I remember this very plainly. During the 2012 election, because the Democrats hate the Paul Ryan budget. By the way, at the end of this show, I say this as a part of my outro. I say the phrase, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Now, I came up with that. It's not really clever. But the reason I added that to the end of every show, and this show started in 2012. The reason I add that to the end of every show is as a protest at the end of every show to the Paul Ryan budget and the Paul Ryan idea of what a budget should look like. Because Paul Ryan's budgets were always about austerity. But they would always call them prosperity. They call them the path to prosperity, the road to prosperity, the road to heaven with prosperity and unicorns and all the rest. And so as a way of making my disgust known about the Ryan budget, I don't think I've ever explained this on the air, I put at the end of every show, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. And I'll do it at the end of this show too. Back in 2012, the Democrats were saying, because Democrats have always hated the Paul Ryan budgets, whatever he comes up with. The Democrats were saying, how do we connect Mitt Romney to the Ryan budget? Because the Democrats felt like if they could connect Mitt Romney to the Ryan budget, which was not popular, popular among some conservatives, but even with some conservatives, it wasn't so great because there were ads that ran about Paul Ryan pushing grandma off the cliff. That was a real thing. And he kind of laughed about pushing grandma off the cliff. But that's what a lot of older people thought about the Ryan budget. They go, it's just going to screw us and everybody else. And when Mitt Romney picked Paul Ryan to be his running mate, the celebrations began nice and early for the Democratic Party. First of all, they're running against an incumbent. Second of all, he just picked Paul Ryan. And the Ryan budget and Grover Norquist, not the Muppet, the tax guy. Grover Norquist, who runs an anti-tax group in Washington, D.C., is a multi-million dollar lobbyist. He said that with Paul Ryan at the top of the ticket, with Mitt Romney, he said, we don't even need Mitt Romney. He goes, you could put anybody in that position. He said, get anybody who has enough working digits to hold a pen that can sign the Paul Ryan budgets, and that's all we need for president. Because he knew the Paul Ryan budget was a slash and burn thing. And Paul Ryan always said that it was because he hated deficits. Right? He hated debt. He wanted America to get back to prosperity by getting rid of all of our debt. So, how did that turn out? How has that gone for Paul Ryan? He left Washington, D.C., or he's going to leave Washington, D.C. in January. That's it. So he's not going to be Speaker of the House. So they'll have to put someone else up for Speaker. His seat opens up, along with 39 or 40 other Republican seats. Right? Those are just open seats now. Democrats only need to take 24 seats to get the House. And by the way, a House that is heavily gerrymandered for the Republicans, heavily gerrymandered in favor of Republicans, looks like it's going to go to the Democrats. So that's just stunning. Did Paul Ryan, the thing that he had been wanting to do his whole life, the dream that he had when, by his own admission, when he was drinking beer in college about cutting deficits and getting government spending under control and making the government smaller. Did that happen? This from CBS News. About a year ago, President Trump pledged to eliminate the national debt over a period of 8 years. But for the first time in U.S. history, the national debt has surpassed $21 trillion this week, according to the U.S. Treasury.
Going to ask every department head in government to provide a list of wasteful spending on projects that we can eliminate in my first 100 days. The politicians have talked about this for years, but I'm going to do it.
We won't let your money be wasted anymore. We're going to run government smoothly, efficiently, and on behalf of the very hardworking taxpayers, something that the taxpayers haven't seen in a long time. I will be holding everybody accountable for that.
One by one, we're checking off the promises we made to the people of the United States. One by one. A lot of promises. And we will not stop until the job is done. We will cut wasteful spending. We will promote our values.
We want to also reduce excessive government spending, and that's what we're working on at our cabinet meeting today.
Quoting here, Republicans railed against the national debt level under the Obama administration when it jumped to $10.6 trillion to $19.9 trillion, nearly doubling, but few have been as outspoken about the situation with Republicans on Capitol Hill and the White House. Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky held up the spending bill that came out last month, the multi-trillion dollar spending bill, blistering Republicans for doing exactly what they criticized the Obama administration for doing. Quote, I ran for office because I was critical of President Obama's trillion-dollar deficits, Paul said at the time. Now we have Republicans hand-in-hand with Democrats offering us trillion-dollar deficits. But the ever-increasing national debt isn't a frequent topic for Mr. Trump when it does come up. He doesn't seem too concerned. He said that he's actually open to raising the debt ceiling. And Paul Ryan, after passing the multi-trillion dollar tax cut, he got a $500,000 check from the Koch brothers. $500,000. And that's not all. Now that he's leaving Congress as Speaker of the House, if he wants, and I imagine he will, because money's the name of the game for this guy. If he wants, he can get a job as a lobbyist starting at $1 million a year. As a member of Congress, I believe it's like $170,000 or $180,000 a year. He's going to leave D.C. He's going to continue to screw the people that sent him there. And he's going to make five times more. And I think what happened with Paul Ryan is he was never really about this particular thing. The Republicans definitely aren't. But he's decided to be more honest about it. And he's leaving D.C. without getting done what he said he wanted to get done. He actually raised the deficit, and he will continue to do so even outside of D.C.
Steve, let me ask you something that's close to home for you and me and at least one other person at this table. John Hyland is here. During the McCain-Palin campaign, it was our job to keep secret the degree to which we were concerned that Sarah Palin might not have been up for the job of vice president, and we did. After the campaign, people like John Heilman and his co-author Mark Halperin wrote a book called Game Change. HBO went on to make a movie. And at that point, which would be the parallel to Rex Tillerson being gone, at that point, we shared some of the things we'd seen and some of the concerns that we had. Talk about, I mean, because what you started out by saying is right, but it's pretty agonizing. Someone that went in and served at the highest levels on behalf of a politician doesn't think they're going to have to come out and talk about what a bleep show it all was.
So that's Nicole Wallace talking with Steve Schmidt on MSNBC. Nicole Wallace is a Republican, worked for the Bush campaign. Steve Schmidt worked for the Bush campaign and worked for the McCain campaign. And what they're pointing out there, what they're allowed to talk about in public now, is all of the things that they helped hide, all of the things that they helped protect during the 2012 election. And they can speak very openly about it now. But it just confirms what we suspected for so long, that these people aren't really insane. They know what they're doing. They know what's going on. Both of these, Nicole Wallace and Steve Schmidt, are both Republicans, but they got so sick of the party, right? And the up is down and black is white, you know, and everything is, it's opposite day. They got so sick of that they went on to news. They could have easily become lobbyists. And for them, they don't get to start at $1 million a year, but they'd have gotten to start off at $500,000 a year, which is still pretty respectable money. But they decided not to. They decided to join the media and go, holy hell, let me tell you about what we did. It was disgusting. So I want to talk with you about the term gaslighting. There's an article over at The Guardian by Ariel LaVey, and the headline, How to Survive Gaslighting When Manipulation Erases Reality. And that's a lot of what we're dealing with. When they talk about how if we cut the budget, give all the money to millionaires, it's going to give us more money. So things that don't make any sense. When they talk about things like that, and then we say, no, that doesn't make any sense. So if you jump into the pool, you're going to be dry. And you go, wait a minute. No, I'm not. If I jump into the pool, I'm going to be wet. And they go, no, you're not. You're going to be dry. Think about it. I have thought about it. I'm going to be freaking wet. And they go, are you sure? Now we're talking about gaslighting. Quoting here, the term gaslighting refers to when somebody manipulates you into questioning and second-guessing your reality. It derives from a 1944 movie and the play and another film that preceded it, in which this happens for the heroine. What perhaps people don't understand is how to manage and cope with it. For me, referring to the author here, it's all fairly familiar. I know this behavior well, and I know how to navigate it. As a child, I was experiencing a world where there was no emotional safety while being consistently told that I had a beautiful and happy childhood and that I was ungrateful. What was I complaining about? Yet I was exposed. What I was exposed to caused me to feel unsafe, and those feelings had a verifiable origin. Whether it was witnessing violent arguments or being on the receiving end of inappropriate behavior, when I confronted my mother with the truth, and I can relate to this, it was denied. My reality was disavowed, and asserting it would only instigate conflict. I was told that what I saw with my own eyes hadn't happened. When I would confront my mother with things that she said or things that she had done, she would say I was making it up, that it was a lie. When I confronted her with facts, they were batted away. So it wasn't just that my reality was canceled, but that my perception of reality was overwritten. As I wrote in my memoir, An Abbreviated Life, it wasn't the loudest or scariest explosions that caused the most damage. Wasn't the physical violence or the verbal abuse or the lack of boundaries and inappropriate behavior. What did the real damage was the denial that these incidents ever occurred. The erasure of the abuse was worse than the abuse. When I was in my mid-30s, I had an encounter with somebody who recognized me from when I was a child. He would say, oh, you're so-and-so's daughter. I nodded. He had been a guest at one of my mother's parties. After I left, he said, I had always wondered what happened to that little girl, how she would survive. I had thought, and this is the man talking about meeting the girl, that her only choices were suicide or murder. When I was told that he said this, I felt validation. And that line stayed with me for many reasons. This outsider observed what I was living through, and having him as a witness confirmed what I knew. So this personal story really relates to what's happening on a national level. We're being gaslit daily by conservative commentators on places like Facebook, where I no longer reside, Twitter, Instagram, Fox News. Gaslighting, constantly. The president will say into the microphone, into a television camera, he will make a statement. And it won't be too much longer after that statement is made, he will say, I did not make that statement. And then when you show him the tape of that statement being made by him, two words, fake news, didn't happen. The Access Hollywood tape, which is having a nice bright white light shone on it again, pretty clearly shows what Trump did on that bus with Billy Bush. And this is just one example. And what he said. And at the time, he confirmed, yeah, I said it, but locker room talk, right? There's that toxic masculinity again. Locker room talk. Now, inside the White House, the fact that this tape has come up again, because of the whole Stormy Daniels thing, there's a huge investigation over it. And also, it looks like that the money that was given to Stormy Daniels and a couple other people that he cheated on his wife with, it looks like those were campaign finance violations. So what's his story now when it comes to the Access Hollywood tape? He is not saying to us, but he is saying to people that work inside the White House that he's pretty sure that tape is doctored. Somebody just made that tape up to make him look bad. He didn't ever really say that. Gaslighting. What's happening on a national level is activating and re-traumatizing a lot of people who have been gaslighted in the past. The crazy-making, mind-bending, massive confusion-inducing effects of our current administration's recklessness with the truth and disregard for verifiable facts is creating an emotional and psychological whiplash. It's affecting people who have been subjected to abusive relationships. People who feel emotionally vulnerable, and it seems to stoke a nearly unprecedented rage in those of us who can see it and feel powerless to do anything to combat it. When people in the mainstream media are being discredited, how exactly are you supposed to call this out? So I got behind a pickup truck the other day, and it had a big CNN sticker on it, and then at the bottom of the sticker, it said, CNN is fake news. I listened to a radio station out of Chicago, WCPT, and their slogan, which came out just after the election, was, listen to WCPT because facts matter. And we live in this post-fact world right now. Believe in the truth. This is from Timothy Snyder. Believe in the truth, because without truth, we don't have trust. Without trust, we don't have the rule of law. Without the rule of law, we don't have democracy. So people who are post-fact, who are against the truth, are taking a direct line to killing democracy. So how do you survive gaslighting? A couple of quick bullet points. Remain defiant. Remember, you live, if you listen to this show, you live in reality. And it's not always pretty. And it's not always fun. But you choose to reside there because, much like me, you can't lie to yourself. Recognize that there will never be accountability. There may never, ever come a point where these people have to say, I lied. Or if they even realize that they are lying. Let go of the wish for things to be different. To think that this is ever going to correct itself is highly unlikely. When people watch something happen before their very eyes and say that it didn't happen, when someone tells you, as my earlier crappy example I was using, to jump in a pool because that's how you stay dry, let go of the idea that they're ever going to realize that they're full of S. And develop a healthy detachment. So I want to talk about that real quick. I've been doing this show for, going on 6 years now. And I do it because I love it. And it's also therapeutic for me. I don't know that if I've mentioned it here on the air, but I've picked what looks like it's going to be an end time for this show. It's not soon. We're episode 248 right now. I'm going to make sure I get all the way to 300. So I'm going to be with you through the midterms and likely through the early part of next year. So probably by next summer. So it's a big wind down, but I like round numbers. And also it's super hard for me to give this up. But part of the reason that I've decided to do so is because of the post-fact world that we live in. I drive around my city, and there is no shortage of cars with InfoWars bumper stickers. As the old saying goes, a lie will make it halfway around the world before the truth even gets its shoes on. Nothing, and I mean nothing, that Alex Jones has ever said is even kind of true. He opens a mic, he's got papers on his desk so it looks legitimate, but then he sits there and he makes things up. Everything. Makes up everything. I'm not even sure his name is Alex Jones. It might be. Where's the birth certificate? But that guy and a lot of other guys like him have these massive engaged audiences by the millions that send them millions of dollars. And it keeps those lies alive. Facebook pages, there's millions of them, and they're all gaslighting and they're all lying. And they've all got millions of followers. Rush Limbaugh, clearly, I listen to his show daily. Lies, lies, lies. Nothing. Nothing he says is true. Sean Hannity, Fox News. Lies, lies, lies. But the people that watch, that celebrate, that believe, where these people have become the pastors in their church, those numbers are in the millions. The fact that I open this mic every week and I do my damnedest to verify this stuff and I bust my ass finding these stories, I've sort of hit a point where it's not enough for me to just open the mic and talk. I would like to have a conversation. I would like to have something where people can call in. And I don't have to make money on this. That's not my thing. If I did, that'd be pretty sweet, but I can do this without the money. because I'm doing fine. But what bothers me is the engagement, that I don't get enough engagement. If I, and our audience is there, we can see it. We can see it in the numbers. We can see it in the downloads. We can see that there are people there. But the engagement is very small. And that bothers me. So I would like to, so in the next year, I'm going to try to do things to build it. I'm going to try to do things to get it on terrestrial radio. But if in a year, I'm in the exact same position where I am now, with the same level of engagement, with the same audience, I'm going to have to hang it up, because it's not enough of me. I want this to be a bigger thing. I want this to make a difference. I'm not here to hear the sound of my own voice. Truth be known, I can't stand the sound of my own voice. I have a terrible voice. But here I am on a microphone recording it because I believe this stuff. And I believe in it so strongly. And it's not enough for me to have information. I have to share it. And we're not going to make a difference until we're engaging a larger audience. And until I'm able to do that, at this point, I'm really just screaming down an empty hallway. Well, not empty. Every so often, somebody walks through it. So that's just a heads up. So, and it doesn't mean that it's going to be a complete death at 300, never looking back. Because radio is in my blood, and I just can't get it out. Even though the jobs in radio are small, the way I feel about this particular medium, I'm always going to feel this way. So it might go to less frequent shows, something of that nature. But the way it is now, where I do this every week, you know, and I do tons and tons of work, and this becomes a third job, you know, and I don't get the engagement that I'm looking for, that particular thing is going to make it, is going to put it on a downslope for sure. And then eventually the show might be quieted. But as the title suggests, it is the fire you can't put out. That fire is not going to be put out. It's just going to burn someplace very different.
No, they don't. And I remember in my case, in May of 2009, I was asked a question at a conference hosted by John King of CNN, who asked what I thought of Sarah Palin as a potential nominee for the presidency in 2012. I answered it in one word. I said it would be catastrophic. There were many, many people long after the hour that it was clear that she was unfit temperamentally, intellectually, from every conceivable character perspective, from a veracity perspective, we're still suspending disbelief and saying, oh yes, this person, because she's on Fox, because she has a rabid fan base, I'm going to say that, yes, she'd be qualified to be president. Eventually, it all comes out.
Your eyes and ears do not deceive you. Refuse to be gaslighted. You know the truth. Follow that particular truth. Okay, before I let you go, I got a few more stories I want to bring to you. Some good news, bad news. But hey, another 10 minutes of your time, I'll let you get back to your families.
An overwhelming portion of the intensely demonstrated animosity toward President Barack Obama is based on the fact that he is a black man. Racism inclination still exists. And I think it's bubbled up to the surface because of a belief among many white people, not just in the South, but around the country, that African Americans are not qualified to lead this great country.
So Tennessee is an interesting place. This from CNN, quoting here, it sounds like the kind of legislation that would easily breeze through a state house, even in these politically divided times. A resolution denouncing white nationalists and neo-Nazis. It didn't even make it out of the committee in the Tennessee legislature, though. The resolution, which was written by Tennessee Democratic Representative John Ray Clemens, it doesn't name any particular group. It calls on law enforcement to go after white nationalists and neo-Nazi groups with the same fervor as other forms of terrorism. Quoting here, we urge law enforcement to recognize that these white nationalist and neo-Nazi groups as terrorist organizations and to pursue the criminal elements of these domestic terrorist organizations in the same manner, with the same fervor, used to protect the United States from manifestations of terrorism. When it came up before the House State Government Subcommittee, it died a quick death. How quick? About 36 seconds. As Clemens started to talk about the bill, the sole Democrat on the five-member committee mentioned to have it discussed. no one in the committee spoke up. Because when you bring it up a committee, someone has to second it, and then it moves forward. Nobody spoke up. The committee chair, Republican State Representative Bill Sanderson, then gaveled the resolution dead. 36 seconds. I'm sorry. Denounce white nationalists and neo-Nazis? Absolutely not. Next. Because the resolution didn't get a second motion to proceed, it means it won't make it to a vote by the full legislature. When asked by WZTV, one Republican member, State Representative Bob Ramsey, said that they didn't have enough information about neo-Nazis or white supremacy to talk about it. Quote, we've got no expertise on it, we said. How can we determine these groups are terrorists? We don't know the federal guidelines on terrorism, unquote. Amazing. The reason they can't denounce these groups is because these are Trump's loyal followers.
Hey, America, well, while I have your attention and you're sitting there defending Starbucks while sipping coffee from your Christmasless red cups, let me explain to you exactly why Starbucks coffee is so bitter and why it's overpriced. That bitter taste? Well, it's a tiny tasteful touch of abortion. Why is it so expensive? Well, they need your money to support Planned Parenthood and the genocide of millions of innocent little babies. So, Starbucks, I'm glad that you're distancing yourself from Christmas and anything Christ, because you're nothing alike. You see, Jesus Christ, he formed, fashioned those beautiful babies in the womb. Well, your customers' money, you use it to pull them out, pull them apart, and sell them to the highest bidder. So, hey, Christians, hope you have fun drinking your abortion coffee.
Abortion coffee, just like mom used to make. So that's Josh Feierstein, and obviously a complete whack job, but also very representative of the deep Christianity that exists in our country, which isn't Jesus Christ Christianity, because that would be crazy. No, it's this whole other brand of Christianity. See, the Republican Party and the vast majority of our Christians in the United States do not live according to any sort of Christian code or according to the Bible or even how Jesus lived. But they would really like you to think that they do. So back to Tennessee, quoting here from the Associated Press, Tennessee lawmakers have passed a bill to require public schools to prominently display the national motto, In God We Trust. It would take effect immediately if the governor, Bill Haslam, signs it. The legislation passed the Senate unanimously and cleared the House in an 81-8 vote with both chambers controlled by Republicans. Now remember, denouncing white supremacists in Tennessee, no way. In God We Trust on the walls of every schoolroom? Hell yeah! The measure requires schools to display the motto in a prominent location, either as a plaque, artwork, or some other art form. Whether this model represents an unconstitutional government endorsement of religion is a question that has invited legal challenges in other states with similar laws. But the bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Susan Lynn, says the bill shouldn't bother faithless people and people of other faiths because it's simply the motto of the country. No, it's not. The governor, Haslam, it's still sitting on his desk. He's not sure if he's going to sign it yet, which means he's definitely going to sign it. See, last year, he signed a bill. Now remember, no neo-Nazis are, no, come, you can't, those are our guys, you can't talk bad about neo-Nazis, but in their schools, on all the walls, in God We Trust, and on their license plates, and this passed just last year in Tennessee. It's optional, you don't have to have it, but you can now go to the DMV and get a Tennessee license plate with God, in God We Trust, printed on the license plate, and that was the bill that was super duper important to pass last year, but saying that neo-Nazis are terrorists, not okay in Tennessee.
There are more other than Mexicans coming over. A lot of, they have been stopping Muslims, Islamics, radical Islamics, Chinese.
Is it possible that there's complicity and organization between the Muslims, the Islamics, the Chinese, and the Obama administration?
Yes.
There are so many frightened white people out there. And it's funny the term snowflake, because they are very white, they are very delicate, they are very conservative. And it's funny how they take that term and they throw it at the liberals, they say, you're so snowflakey. But it's y'all white people that are afraid of everything, up to and including your own shadow. But I suppose I can't blame you, conservatives, for being afraid of your shadow. It is, after all, black. So the headline over at The Guardian is, as elections near, Many older, educated white voters are shifting away from Trump's party. So this is on two fronts. First of all, they're shifting away from the party itself, and they're shifting away from Trump. Now, one of the most surprising things I learned when I read this article is one of the things that's driving those older white voters away from Trump is healthcare. See, we have this thing called mortality. And as we get older, well, our bodies don't work quite like they used to. And we all need healthcare, at the very least, access to health care. And if you don't have a doctor in your family, and most of us don't, you're going to need health care, comprehensive health care at some point. And Trump, just still to this day, every time he hits the mic, we're going to strip everyone of their health care. What? That's not a good idea. Because it's the older, frightened white people that you're going to stop their damn hearts talking about how you're going to take away all their health care. But I'm just glad that those people are moving away from him. Oh, and a little bit of good news before I send you on your way.
I mean, it's only fitting that a president who spends so much of his time in office trying to control women's bodies, that he might go down because he isn't able to control his body. And that is honestly the best case scenario, right? In this, in all of these stories, not all of them, but the two, involving adult film stars, is that he had affairs with these women, right? That he's a cheating pig. That's the best case scenario right now.
I'm glad that the Trump presidency has motivated the feminist movement in this country like never, ever before. Women and men who are allies of the women's movement have never had a better motivator than one Donald Trump. And this from the New York Daily News, there are over 500 women running for office in 2018. The year of the woman, that's what 1992 was referred as, because of so many women that ran for government in that particular year. But this year, and the number sits at 526 so far, with more and more getting in every day, this is really going to be the year of the woman, because this is going to beat the crap out of 1992. So many women. So November looks good, with not just so many Republicans leaving these seats open, so that it's less likely that their particular party is going to win those seats. And it's every year now, every year, from starting the day after the inauguration, including this last year, where the Women's March gets out there and tells, we are not okay with what you're doing. Men that practice the same BS that you're practicing, we are not okay with that. And the Me Too movement, also very prominent during his presidency, he has to hate every little bit of this. But I, as a militant feminist, I love every single second of this. So looking forward to November. All right, let you go back to your families. I'm going to go back to my family. Ladies and gentlemen, fire you can't put out. Boom! Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or at Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, just a general statement or inquiry. You can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So, feel free to reach out to us, and as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail. And here it is, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Goodbye, Paul Ryan. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thank you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.